this is something I've been looking forward to for, well, almost a year, I guess, since Dale and Ray called me up one day and said, can we have lunch? We want to ask you something. And you know, I think there's really many connections between the center and myself, as Ray has said. You know, I was 12 years on the board, as Ray mentioned, and it's wonderful that there are members. Well, I was, of course, on the board with Tony for all those years that I was that I was on the board, and my connection with Ina Grace and Paul goes really way back. I think my first formal connection was with Ina Grace, who I asked her to come in and talk in one of my classes at CTU, and then from then on we began to connect, and she got me on the board and so forth, and Ray and Dale, we really have been friends throughout this whole time, and I'm very committed to the vision of the center, the vision of a missional church, a prophetic church, a church in dialogue with the world, and so it's really wonderful to be able to talk about this today. Let me just tell you about the plan of the four talks. Of course, it's in your packet and in your program book. But my first talk, which will be the talk this afternoon, is going to be a kind of a theology of mission. So just kind of lay out in general how I understand mission. And I'll talk about that, of course, much more in a couple of minutes. And then tomorrow, I'm going to talk about where we do mission, just a little bit, very small analysis of the context here in the United States. And then how we do mission, and that introduces the whole idea, what I really call the spirituality out of which we do mission, and that is a prophetic dialogue. And in a book that my friend and colleague Roger Schrader and I published in 2004 called Constants and Contexts, we outline at the end of that book what we call six elements of mission. And in this context, I'm calling them practices of mission as well. And we're taking two of those elements, looking first at the element or practice of witness and proclamation. That will be our third talk. And then finally, our fourth talk will be the practice of interreligious and secular dialogue. There are four more, but we just don't have time, you know, to do that in the detail and really the leisure that we want to do in these days together. So let me begin. That's the other thing. I hope that I won't be too Catholic. I realize my context. It's wonderful to have my student Kurt Lang here, who's a deacon out in Naperville, and I know Father Pat is here. I don't know if there are any other Catholics in the group, but I hope I won't be too Catholic. I've tried. You know, that's who I am. That's what I come out of, and you'll see lots of that with pictures of Pope Francis and Pope John Paul II and so forth like that. But that's who I am, and I hope that I've also been able to be as broad as I can be as well. So pardon me if it's too narrow, but on the other hand, that's the place where I come from. And all of us, I think, have to have a place and are rooted in a place. So let's begin with our first presentation, first talk, which, as you know, is called Partnering with the Missionary God, an Invitation to the Dance. What I hope to do in this presentation is to help us think in a kind of a fresh way about the idea of mission. And if I would put it in one phrase, the phrase would be this: that mission is Trinitarian practice. mission is Trinitarian practice. Now, what do I mean by Trinitarian practice? Well, I mean that mission is doing what God is already doing in the world. Or to paraphrase a wonderful phrase of the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, it's finding out what the Trinity is doing in the world and joining in. So, in other words, mission is partnering with God. It's dancing with God. God invites us to dance with God's self in this wonderful dance of mission, of healing, of reconciliation, of joy, and so forth. Now, in order to do this kind of unpacking of this rather tight phrase, mission is Trinitarian practice, what we have to do is begin with an understanding of God's deepest self. And ironically, we come to understand God in God's deepest self as we understand how God actually works in the universe. Now, we don't know God, you know, through, as the theologian Elizabeth Johnson says, through, you know, some kind of high-powered telescope of doctrine. We rather know God by the way that God has, as Johnson says, drawn near and passed by in cosmic and human history. And so this presentation is going to have four parts. We're going to start out by talking about how God is a verb, then how God is mission, then how the mission has a church, and then finally how mission is partnering with God. So let's look first of all at the first point, which is that God is a verb. In 2009, I spent a semester in Australia, and I was giving a number of lectures on the theology of mission around Australia. And as I worked out my talk, I began to get this conviction that in order to understand mission, we have to begin with the idea that the best way to speak about God is not as a noun, but rather as a verb. Of course, you know, there's no way you can ever speak absolutely about God. You know, God is incomprehensible. God is ineffable. There's no way we can understand. There's no way we can ever express the reality of God. And yet, it seems to me that the idea of trying to imagine God as a verb somehow or another captures this idea of God's illusory, ineffable, incomprehensible nature in a particularly vivid way. You know, how do you capture running? How do you capture flowing? How do you capture embracing? You know, it's somehow letting our imagination go in that direction that I think helps us see that God offers God's self and yet nevertheless remains mystery. Now, this is not really a new idea. It's actually a very traditional idea. I was surprised when I began to think about this that you can go back, for instance, to Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas talks about God as actus purus, pure act, pure activity. I always thought that that meant kind of static, you know, God was being itself. But God is the act of being. You know, God is pure activity. Or as Thomas Aquinas's great contemporary Bonaventure says, this is Elizabeth Johnson expressing the idea of Aquinas, that God is the verb in which all beings participate, live, and move, and have their being. And then we go to Aquinas' great contemporary, Bonaventure, who talks about God as self-diffusive love. A number of years ago, I was on a panel with one of my colleagues, Tony Gittins, a wonderful missiologist and great speaker. And Tony referred to this as God is love hitting the cosmic fan. I love that. You know, that God is love hitting the cosmic fan. Another contemporary of Aquinas and Bonaventure, maybe less known, is a woman by the name of Mechthild of Magdeburg, one of the great medieval mystics. And she speaks about God as that great outflow of love which never ceases. For Mechthild, God as such is a flow. A flow of communion. And she talks about the Father in, you know, the medieval, more exclusive language, as the restless Godhead, a flow that no one can block. And she speaks about the Son as constantly recurring richness that no one can contain except the boundlessness which always flowed and shall ever flow from God, and which comes again as the fullness of the Son. So Mechthild has this idea of God just flowing through creation, moving, constantly moving around in a constant kind of motion. Contemporary theology, too, has talked about this idea of God as a verb. I already mentioned Elizabeth Johnson. There's a younger, wonderful lay theologian in the Catholic Church by the name of Edward Hannenberg, who uses the same kind of imagery. But let's go back a little bit to Karl Barth. Karl Barth says in one of his many, many writings that with regard to the being of God, the word event or act is final. Robert Jensen, great Lutheran theologian, in his systematic theology, talks about God as a fugue, so the image more of music, but that, you know, that movement of a fugue, that in and out flowing and so forth, or as a conversation, or again, to use Barth's idea, the idea of an event. Paul Fides, a Baptist theologian who I met a couple of years ago in England, talks about God as the mystery of participation. He has a wonderful book that's called Participating in God, A Pastoral Approach to the Trinity. And he talks about God as a mystery of participation. And he talks about God as an act of persuasion, an act of persuasion to come into that flow, to come into that conversation, to come into that communion that God is in God's self. And he says the divine persuasion is the attractiveness of movements of love, patterns of the dance into which we are all swept up. Just this summer, I read the latest book of a wonderful Catholic theologian by the name of Elia Dalio. She is a trained scientist, and she writes books about theology and evolution. And her latest book that came out this spring is called The Unbearable Wholeness of Being. And she writes there that she says that God is, well, where there is energy of attraction, union, generativity, and life, there is God. So, you know, these ideas of contemporary theology. And also, some of you may be familiar with a Catholic. He's a Franciscan. He's a spiritual writer and noted speaker, a man by the name of Richard Rohr. Richard Rohr has a wonderful set of CDs on the Trinity. The first CD is about the Trinity in general, and then he has one on Father, Son, and Spirit. But in the first CD, he talks about the fact that God is the force of attraction that holds every atom and subatomic particle together. God is what is between those particles, you know. God is not being so much as interbeing. So all these metaphors, you know, that theology today is using. Rohr also, like many theologians, plays on the idea of the 8th century concept, St. John Damascene, the concept of perichoresis, or that moving around, which can be played at because it's similar to the Greek word for dance. And Rohr emphasizes the idea that God is not the dancer, God is the dance itself. Over the years have begun to image that. And one of the things that I think of about God's dance is, I don't know if you're familiar with this this dance, the conga, where somebody gets up and starts moving, you know, to a Latin beat, something like that, and then somebody grabs onto their back, and I can just see us going through the room, you know, you do it at weddings and things like that, and you move through the tables and you move through the room. Well, that's God. You know, God starts that dance and then brings people together into that wonderful dance of joy and relationship and so forth, and moves through the world. And people are called to join in that dance. Richard Rohr also has a wonderful image of God as a rubber band. I mean, talk about kind of simple, but God is a rubber band. He says, you know, he was. Let me go back a bit. He says, as he was giving this talk, he said, you know, before I came here, I was in my hotel room and I knelt down on the floor to pray a little bit to kind of, you know, make sure that, you know, what I said would be, God's word and not my own word. And he says, my eye caught, there was a rubber band down on the floor. And he said, I picked it up and, you know, it's got God, you know, moves out and then gathers in, you know. And then God moves out and then gathers in, and then sends those that God has gathered out again to gather others in. And so that whole movement, that's the movement of God, that flow of God throughout history, throughout our world. Kathleen Cahalan, young Catholic theologian who teaches up at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. She talks about how, you know, we realize that if we want to know what God is, we got to look at what God does. So she says, you know, what God is in essence is what God does. And Ed Hanenberg, who I mentioned before, says that the crucial move in Trinitarian theology is to see that God works for communion. And the fact that God works for communion reveals, because God is what God does, reveals what God is in God's center, in God's deepest self. So this leads us then to our second point, another metaphor bringing all these together, that God is mission. God is the movement, we said. God is the flow. God is the dance, the embrace of creation that calls creation to its fullness, to its wholeness, and where necessary, especially in the human community, healing. God Works, as the new document from the World Council of Churches that's going to be presented this fall in their assembly, God works for the fullness of life, of course, alluding to John 10:10. God's the mystery of participation. This is amazing to me. You know, God is that mystery of participation that calls women and men on this tiny speck of a planet in a minor galaxy in an immense universe into relationship, into partnership, partnership in calling others to relationship and partnership. In other words, inviting people to the dance. Another way of saying this, of course, is that God is mission. The first act of mission was the act of creation. From the first nanosecond, God is dancing in the world. God is present in the world through the Spirit. Dennis Edwards, the Australian theologian, talks about how the Spirit is the way God guides and persuades and inspires the evolution, first of all, of the gases. That takes about, you know, 10 billion years, you know, in the whole process of creation. In the formation of the really billions of planets that are in billions of galaxies. And eventually, at least on our planet, calling forth life. And then committing God's self to healing and reconciliation as free-willed and, of course, stubborn humans begin to emerge. And then it's the Spirit that's active, as Vatican II says in its document on mission, as a secret presence in all the emerging religions, you know, among humankind. As humankind begins to evolve in consciousness and civilization. Now, in our Judeo-Christian tradition, of course, this imminent, always present, life-giving, persuading, inspiring, healing, reconciling presence of God is imaged in the Old Testament in these really elusive kind of images. Wind, or breath, or oozing oil, or flowing water, or a soaring bird, or a brooding bird, whatever it might be. And so the Spirit in the Old Testament is revealed in the many practices of the Spirit. So in Genesis, for instance, we read how the Spirit is depicted as a creative wind blowing over that primeval chaos. And the author of Genesis talks about how the Spirit is like a mother bird who's brooding over her nest. And then the Spirit is depicted as breathing life into that earth creature, Ha-Adam. Breathing life into that first intelligent creature. Other places in the Old Testament, we see how the Spirit comes down on, for instance, Saul, and impels Saul to prophesy. Or how the Spirit, in that beautiful image from Ezekiel 37, blows over that valley of the dry bones, and how the bones, when the Spirit comes across, begin to rattle, and they begin to find one another, and they begin to knit each other together, and then flesh comes on them, and then that Spirit blows life again into them, and how the Spirit is an agent of healing and new life. And then that beautiful image in Ezekiel 47, where the Spirit is like that water that trickles and then flows and then gushes out of the temple. And everything it touches has new life. And the trees that grow along the river that begins to form bear fruit every month. And the leaves are used for healing. The Spirit is also the ointment that anoints prophets for mission, to give comfort to the afflicted, to heal the brokenhearted, to give freedom to those in captivity, as we read in Isaiah chapter 61. And in the book of Proverbs, the Spirit is depicted as Sophia, a woman prophet and street preacher. It talks about how she goes through the streets preaching repentance to men and women. And so Elizabeth Johnson says, kind of in summary, when we speak of the Spirit, what we are actually signifying is God drawing near and passing by in vivifying, sustaining, renewing, and liberating power in the midst of historical struggle. And then in the fullness of time, God's palpable yet still elusive Spirit takes on human flesh, takes on a human face. So if the Spirit is a major way that the Bible describes God's practice of healing and prophecy and calling to repentance and giving new life and so forth, now the Spirit that has pervaded the universe from its first instant, from its first nanosecond, is, as Elizabeth Johnson says, manifest in time in the loving, gifting, and befriending first century Jewish carpenter turned prophet. I think this is seen particularly in the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. Earlier this year, we had a couple of Sundays in our lectionary where we were reading from the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. And it really struck me, that relationship between the Spirit and Jesus. And Luke, of course, who is, you know, the Gospel of the Holy Spirit, Luke brings this out really wonderfully, I think. He talks about, right in the beginning of the Gospel, after the infancy narratives and so forth, how the Spirit descends on Jesus at His baptism in the form of a dove. And then, after the baptism, it's interesting, Luke kind of switches scenes and does this thing of genealogy. But the genealogy is interesting. Matthew has Jesus going back to Abraham. So he's the faithful Jew, you know, the fulfiller of the law. Luke has Jesus going back to Adam, to Ha-Adam, into whom the Spirit first breathed life. And then Jesus is described as full of the Spirit and led into the desert to be tempted by the evil spirit, and he struggles with the evil spirit and has victory over the evil spirit. And then after defeating the devil, Jesus again is described twice, I believe, in this section as filled with the Holy Spirit as he goes around and begins to preach in the various synagogues. What's interesting, though, what struck me is that except for, you know, Jesus, 12-year-old Jesus, talking to his mother and father in the temple, Jesus has not said a word yet in the Gospel of Luke. As an adult, he has not said a word. So if the Spirit comes on him at baptism, he is described as, you know, linked to the first human creature. he does battle with the evil spirits. He is filled with the Spirit, and then he comes to his hometown and his home synagogue. And Luke has him then go up, and he takes out the scroll, and he reads. And these are the first words of Jesus, the adult, in the Gospel of Luke. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." And then he lays out his agenda. You know, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. God has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, to bring sight to the blind, to proclaim a year of favor, etc., etc." So this is, of course, Jesus' agenda for his mission that Luke leads out. But it's fascinating to me that this is really the first word of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, is that he is filled with the Spirit. It's as if, you know, the Spirit has given him the baton in the relay, and now he is the embodiment of everything God has been doing from the first instant of creation, from that first moment of mission. So God's mission of healing and giving life and sanctifying and so forth is now taken over by Jesus. And so Jesus reveals in his own practice what the practice of God is, the practice of the Trinity is. And Jesus proclaims God's message of acceptance and forgiveness and reconciliation and inclusion, commitment to the poor. You know, he's going to bring the good news to the poor in these stunning parables. Parables, for instance, about God's mercy. Luke 15. Scholars say that if we lost every other aspect of the Gospels, if somehow or another they disappeared, and we only had Luke 15, we would have everything. Those three parables of the shepherd going in search of the lost sheep, of the woman tearing apart her house to find that lost coin, and finally, the father waiting patiently for his lost son and enduring the insults of his other son. This is really a picture about, you know, God's incredible overflowing mercy, or about God's generosity. The parable in Matthew 20 about the workers in the vineyard, that parable that's a nightmare for labor organizers and so forth. And yet, what it's about, that they all worked at some point, but some worked more and some worked less, but they're all given the same amount. "Shouldn't I be generous?" the owner of the vineyard says. Shouldn't God be generous? And God is generous, giving, you know, everything to everyone in equal measure. God's radical inclusion, as we see in Matthew 22. "Go into the highways and byways. Bring everyone to my wedding feast." That symbol, of course, of the reign of God. And then a wonderful parable that in Luke 18 about God's vulnerability and God's commitment to justice. Luke 18, if you remember, is the parable about, it's usually called the widow and the unjust judge. And Luke seems to have, you know, how would you say, edited the thing to make it into a kind of a parable about persistence in prayer. But it always struck me, there's something wrong with that. You know, I mean, if God is supposed to be the unjust judge, and the woman is supposed to be us, and we're kind of, please, 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 you know, we have to debase ourselves before this, you know, what kind of God is that? It was really interesting. One of my colleagues at CTU, Barbara Reed, she's a wonderful scholar of New Testament, she reinterprets the parable, and she says, what if we see the woman as God, and the unjust judge as the injustices of the world, and how God is the one who is constantly, in vulnerability, is constantly working for justice. And every once in a while, gets a small victory. You know, it's an amazing way to look at it. And Barbara says, you know, God has been depicted as a woman in the parable of the lost coin, in the little parable about how the kingdom of God is like leaven that a woman puts in the yeast. So this is something that Luke does. You know, and so why not see it that way? And in some ways, it's a kind of a parable that even reflects God's fullest revelation of God's self is on the cross in total vulnerability. Why can't this be a parable about God's vulnerability and God's absolute commitment to justice? So Jesus has these incredible parables, which reveals, I think, the practice of God. He also has powerful healings and exorcisms. As he says again in his agenda in Luke 4, recovery of sight to the blind, release to captives. These, I think, are parables in action. You know, they're not just proofs that Jesus is divine or, you know, that kind of thing. They show in action what God is actually doing. They show in action, you know, the same kind of things that Jesus is talking about in his parables. And I think they point out that God's practices, what God is doing in the world, is not just some kind of spiritual thing, disembodied thing. It's actually fully human. That God gets down and really gets dirty with human beings. And then finally, Jesus himself was a parable. His own practices of personal freedom, for instance, in regard to the law. His fun-loving lifestyle. You know, he was accused of being a party animal, you know, a wine bibber, you know, his inclusive behavior, hanging around with all these strange characters, these marginal characters in his society. I think this all points to a God, again, who gives life and joy, who cares for all, who offers inclusion, and who really gives humanity and the cosmos real freedom. The community of this is what Jesus calls the reign of God. And this, I think, captures his idea that I'm preaching a year of favor to the Lord. I'm calling people into this community of inclusiveness, of freedom, of joy, of new life. But of course, the way Jesus did that was the problem. As the Latino theologian Virgilio Elizondo says, Jesus' practice of not being scandalized by anyone was the very thing that caused the greatest scandal to the leaders of the community. And probably, Elizondo says, the biggest reason why the Jewish leaders plotted Jesus' death. So Jesus died because of what he practiced. A friend of mine, Australian missiologist Noel Connolly, says that Jesus' death, it's not the denial of divinity, but the true revelation of it, we said before. Or as the great German theologian Eberhard Jungel says, the crucified one is virtually the real definition of God. God's practice of absolute vulnerability, dying because of the way that God lived, the way that Jesus lived, I think expresses, again, the practice of God. So we come then to our third point, which is the mission as a church. I love this slide here. This is from my Philippine days. This is what Filipinos call the bayanihan, Bayan means people. And what they do is that if they have to move a house, they get the whole village together. And the people carry the house, you know, to the new site. And I think that's a wonderful image of what church is all about, the Bayanihan spirit. You know. Anyway, when I was in Australia in 2009, on Good Friday of 2009, Michael Lunig, who is a very famous cartoonist in Australia, published this cartoon in the Daily Paper in Melbourne, where I was standing. And the caption underneath this is, "Look at that. Brilliant," as the one centurion is talking to the other. "Look at that, brilliant. You kill the leader and you nip the whole movement in the bud." But of course we know it didn't happen that way. We know that you can't kill God. You can't stop that flow. You can't stop that embrace, which is God. The Australian theologian John Thornhill says, "God will have his way. Love will have its way." So you can't stop that movement, that flow, that dance that is God. You can't stop the practice, which is God. And so within days, those disciples who fled in terror in the garden, or who had left Jerusalem on the way to Emmaus disillusioned, or who had locked themselves away in fear, they began to experience that Jesus was alive, that Jesus had been raised from the dead. But not only that, at Pentecost, those disciples began to realize that the Spirit and the mission that was given to Jesus was now given to them. So just as the Spirit's practices of life-giving, freeing, prophecy, forgiving, and so forth were embodied in the person of Jesus, so now those practices begin to be embodied in them. It happened gradually. It didn't just happen like that. You know, I think, you know, the original idea that mission was only to the Jews gradually gave way, as we read the Acts of the Apostles, to the understanding that the gospel was actually for all. I like to say that the church really didn't begin at Pentecost. That was just the beginning of a process where the Spirit was leading the disciples to something wider. And you really see this with Stephen, for instance, in Acts 7. You begin to see that he had an inkling that, you know, Judaism isn't the end. You know, the temple is not the real thing. Jesus is more than that. Of course, they stone him. The community is persecuted. They scatter to various places, and some go to the Samaritans. This is in Acts 8. Samaritans, who are half Jews, they aren't full-blooded Jews. The Jews look down upon them. And yet, when Philip preaches to the Samaritans, they accept the word with open arms. How is this possible? You know, so some of the 12 come from Jerusalem, check it out, and sure enough, they got it. They got the same Spirit that the original community had. And in the same chapter, you see the Ethiopian eunuch, who I like to call a wannabe Jew. He couldn't be a Jew because of his physical condition. And there's a line in Exodus that says eunuchs cannot be members of the community of God. But he loved Judaism, was obviously at the temple, was praying at the temple, was on his way home to Ethiopia, and here he is reading Isaiah, the suffering servant, not understanding, and literally out of the blue, there's Philip. And Philip teaches him about Jesus. And then there's water that they pass by, and he says, "Well, can I be baptized? I can't be a Jew." can I be baptized? Is it possible? And Philip says, of course. And so this wannabe Jew, this Gentile, is baptized. And then Cornelius, a Gentile, a member of the occupying army, calls Peter. Peter comes. Peter preaches to him, and before he even finishes his spiel, the Spirit descends upon them all. And Cornelius and his whole family begin talking in tongues, and they receive the Spirit. When Peter goes back to Jerusalem, he gets chided. How could you possibly do that? That guy's a Gentile. We don't bring Gentiles into our community. But the Spirit's pushing them, you know, gradually. It's almost like, you know, half Jews, wannabe Jews, Gentiles, and then Antioch. Antioch, where it says some of those who were persecuted went to Antioch, they preached to Jews, but they also preached to Gentiles, and the Gentiles accepted, sounds like in droves. And when, again, a delegation from Jerusalem goes to check it out, it's absolutely true that they have really received the Spirit. And so it seems to me, you know, that when at Antioch they finally really cross the boundaries of Judaism, you know, and realize that the gospel is for all peoples, for all times, in every place, that the church was born. So I think the church was not so much born at Pentecost, which was kind of the beginning of a process. It was really born at Antioch, when the church stepped over those boundaries of culture and religion and began to say that the gospel is for everyone. So it's in realizing that they had been invested with God's mission and practice, it's when they realized that they understood themselves then as church. So the church really, I think, comes to be in mission. As we engage in mission, we begin to form ourselves into the church whose purpose is the mission of God. So this is why Vatican Council II talks about the church as missionary by its very nature. That it is mission that constitutes who we are as church. Or as Paul VI says in a wonderful document that he wrote in 1975, that evangelization is the church's deepest identity. And this is why we can say it's not the church that has a mission. It's the mission, it's God's mission that has us, that forms us into a church. So if we're going to be church, we can't get out of being involved in mission. It's exactly what forms us into who we are. So the church becomes the church as it engages in these practices of the Trinity, as it engages in Trinitarian practice. So I come to my fourth and final point, which is mission as partnering with God. The mission theology that I've been developing, and I'm sure it's, you know, not new to any of you, really, is really the theology of the mission of God. You know, this idea of the Missio Dei, which has a long history in Christian theology. It has roots certainly in the Christian scriptures. It's present in the earliest theologians of the church through the Middle Ages. It appears in the Catholic Church and the French school in the 17th century. The 20th century, Karl Barth resurrects this idea in his Church Dogmatics, the great meeting of the World Council of Churches in Willingen in Germany, takes this Barthian idea through the work of Karl Hartenstein and so forth. Vatican II takes this up when it talks about, in the beginning of its document on mission, talks about the church as missionary by its very nature, because mission flows from the sending of the Son and the Spirit by the Father. And in the New World Council of Churches document, which is, I say, going to be presented to the World Council in October. It uses this mission of God, this Missio Dei approach. And the basic idea of this is that the mission is God's, it's not ours. God's mission calls forth the church. God's mission is wider than the church's mission. God is primary. God's the primary actor. We are secondary. And our task is to point out where God is already at work. Now, this is absolutely true, but I'd like to press this a little bit further. This is some new territory that I'm going in, and I haven't quite worked it out yet or anything. It's not exactly quite fully developed yet. I've kind of written it down, but I'm not sure I can articulate it as well as I can. But I don't think we should say that God's primary and we're secondary. You know, I think this is the classical mission of God, Missio Dei idea. I don't think we're exactly subordinate to God as we participate in God's mission. I think much more we are partners. Think about that. It's amazing that God has called us to be partners, not instruments. God has called us to be partners because I think it's God's nature to be a partner. God can't do anything except be a partner. That's what the Trinity is about. The Trinity is, God is partnership. And the way God acts, God's practice, is to call people, you know, not to be instruments, not to be secondary things, you know, but to be partners. As I say, I think partnership is the basic practice of the Trinity. I think it's the whole point, really, of the Incarnation. I think it's why Christianity is really different from other religions. You know, and I'm not saying that God is not present in other religions or anything else, but why I think we still need to preach the gospel with enthusiasm, because we say that God has become one of us, that God has become our partner in history, and that God calls us to be partners in God's work. So, you know, back to Paul Fittis, that idea that the Trinity is a mystery of participation. And in my view, you know, the amazing grace is that somehow or another, we are the way that God's work gets done. You know, we talk about the church as the sacrament of salvation. We are the way that God's work gets done. St. Augustine has this wonderful line, "Without God, we cannot. Without us, God will not." And I think about all those traditions in the scriptures and in theology and so forth. We talk about we are God's adopted sons and daughters. What does that mean? You know, adopted children aren't any less children, you know, of parents, you know, not natural children, but we're adopted sons and daughters. Or as the Greek Orthodox talk about, that in baptism, we are divinized. The idea of theosis, radical, radical stuff, that our whole being, you know, is changed when we are baptized. I think what being divinized means is not that we have, you know, superpowers or things like that, but that God calls us to do what God does. And God is doing, you know. And so we're baptized into that life. We're baptized into that nature. I ran across a little line from Karl Rahner recently, the great 20th century Catholic theologian. The fate of God is with the world. No, it's this kind of idea. So it's not, you know, that this is, I think, an amazing grace. Mission is not something that we do because God told us to do it. You know, mission is something that we take up because we've been given this amazing grace to be partners as God continues to create the world. You know, so I think it's an amazing, remarkable, really ineffable kind of idea. And even when I think the Spirit works outside the church, she still needs people's cooperation. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on an early 20th century, very obscure Scottish Presbyterian theologian by the name of John Oman. And one of my favorite lines from John Oman is, God does not force his mystery upon us. We got to be partners. You know, we can't, you know, he's very much against that idea of, sometimes caricatured of Calvin, you know, that grace is irresistible, you know, that, you know, God gives you grace and, you know, you can't not accept it. You know, God never forces God's mystery upon us. But when God calls us to be partners, real sharers in the divine doing, real sharers in the divine nature. And our task, I think, is to have the openness, the humility, the availability of someone like Mary. I think that's what the angel, when the angel comes and says, you know, again, in the Gospel of Luke, hail full of grace. It means you who have put no barriers between yourself and being a partner with God. You know, that's who you are. You know, that's who Mary is, and why Mary, I think, is such a model for us. And so I think, like Mary, I think we're called to cooperate fully in God's work. And I think this is the amazing grace of mission or evangelization. It's this participating in the work of the Trinity. It's participating in Trinitarian practice. It's partnering. It's dancing with the missionary God. So, ultimately, the question is, do you want to dance? That's the big question, I think, for these days, and I think the question of our lives. Do you want to dance? Do you want to join that great conga line? You know, that moves through history, that's been actually there, moving through history, moving through the cosmos since the beginning of time. Dance will go on without us. But if we join, imagine how we'll be transformed. Imagine how we'll be stretched and moved and developed in all sorts of direction. I want to end this presentation with a longer quotation, which is from the last, I think it's the second last paragraph of Rogers and my book, Prophetic Dialogue. And I think it moves us then into the next, well, how do we do the dance? You know, and we do it by participating in the practice of prophetic dialogue. And here's the quotation. The name of the dance might be called prophetic dialogue. It is based on the beautiful but complex rhythm of dialogue and prophecy, boldness and humility, learning and teaching, letting go and speaking out. It is beautiful because it is the rhythm of God's love moving through history. It is complex because it changes with time, place, creation's groaning, and humanity's response. It is the rhythm of an African drumbeat, a salsa band, a Filipino tinikling, a protest march, a ballroom waltz. Learning how to dance in step with the ever-changing rhythm, however, is not easy at all. When does the rhythm call for dialogue, for humility, for letting go? When does it call for prophecy, for teaching, for speaking out? The Spirit who leads the dance knows, and those of us who follow need to be attentive to her leading and to follow the example of those witnesses at the head of the line. So, first presentation. Ray?
Thank you, Steve. What a gift. We have a little time. We're going to end up taking a break, but let me suggest that just even as this is washing over you, that you turn to one another around table. You may not say anything, but I think what might be helpful is to just unpack a little bit. What struck you? You've been listening intently. What's emerging? What's surfacing? Just a little bit of sharing. Let me give you give everybody a little bit of airtime, 5 minutes or so, and then let's come back to see if there's a question that might emerge from the table. We don't have too much time because we want to get a full 15-minute break. So by quarter to the hour, we're going to break, and then we'll begin our Bible study with Luke starting at 4 o'clock. All right? But let me just invite you to churn, and if you just need to step away, feel free to do that.
The question that now has been swelling in this the dance is happening. Everywhere. And I feel like the church isn't aware. And that God is moving in places that are not the church. And I don't know what to do. Just for example, I think I may have even shared this last summer. I had taken my daughter to Portland to live, to go to school, and ran across Burning Man. Do you know Burning Man?
Okay.
Burning Man is a movement that began as sort of an art creative expression. But they have principles. If you look it up on the internet, that are so radically like the early church theory, radical inclusion, giving away. And so my daughter lives with this woman who's adopted from the man community. My son has died from a man community here in the Midwest. Neither one of them go to church anymore, but they're involved in this movement that still embodies sort of that goodness and inclusion. What is that? What is that saying? What are we to do as a church?
Kind of that I've been listening to you. A couple of questions that came to my mind as I listened to him that I had to write down because I need to think about it. How might the Spirit push into the church today? And we're trying to push back. Because I think there's a lot of control issues in the church. And also, what are the
barriers that they need
to
bring
up to be a
participant?
After all, we do have to have our own agenda. Susan Scott, he or she can buy.
Might be thinking something different from
you. We sort of forget sometimes. We're not.
Being a missionary and going to a place where they've never heard of Jesus Christ, but going with a sense of awe and humility to recognize God's already there. God's truth is already there. God's Spirit is already there. Before I can open my mind and think, I've got it. You know, this sense of arrogance that I have that, you know, and you don't, is to listen and engage and become, begin to appreciate the truth that it gives you. what God's doing, and then only when appropriate, in terms of the context, can begin to hold up the clarity of Christ's witness in ways. But when I take it out of the context of going to some, you know, far off community or something like that, and think about Chicago or, you know, Lincoln Park or whatever year, there are all these fresh expressions of the Spirit. In some ways, the church is Episcopal Diocese of Massachusetts was here with us years ago, their bishop and several others, and they were so excited about fresh expressions. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a whole movement in trying to encourage the movement of the Spirit outside of formal religion.
Sure.
Like Burning Man or what, and because it was never about going to church. It was all about
it's about being
a part of the dance. It's about being part of what God's doing.
Absolutely.
What God is already doing.
And when there's a disconnect between how we focused on God's creation, the wake-up call is how do we realign
and the area of pain for me, I had shared that both of my children are not involved in church.
Okay.
They've found this thing called Burning Man, which speaks to them. But the pain is that I can be talking with my children and I see the connections. But if I start to speak with them as a Christian, my son will say,
But even in that, I think that God has a way of giving us a unique opportunity to participate in both ways. And I think in that context, and I can't understand the level of frustration associated with that. One, because no one who is invited to the dance or in the space of the dance likes to be stepped on. So having said that, I think that even in the midst of what you're faced with right now, it's more than leading, it's trying to listen and to discern what is being said when one responds by saying, don't talk to me about that. Because I think we want to thrust ourselves to be the dancer.
The lead.
The lead.
I'm going to lead this dance.
Right.
Yeah.
Rather than, and I pray you appreciate the spirit by which I'm approaching this, but being somewhat submissive and obedient to even let
the image of Mary.
Yeah, to even let your son be the one who's leading.
He's the prophet.
And so you're in a dialogue. Because what you say, my brother, is when you go back to being invited to perhaps a foreign country, and you go with a missionary mindset, there's a level of arrogance, to use your adjective. And so you have to be able to break down that barrier before you can begin to participate in the dance, as it were. Because those realities are there. And so how do we overcome that in order to begin to navigate the rhythm of life? So I think my prayer for you is that you will be in a position to do something that is perhaps a bit counterculture to mother. And that is to be one who just listens to my child.
I have promised to do that. Every once in a while I find myself just being caught up and
that's an eternal instinct.
Yeah. Well, but just being caught up in the enthusiasm and sharing from my place. And I have to remember I need to, like you said, today.
Totally honest. The story that illustrates it in my own life. I'm Roman Catholic. We raised our kids Catholic. Catholic grade school. participate in the lectures. They're all adults now. Our daughter, Kate, is married. Mm-hmm. I mean, she married a churchgoer man particularly, but now they have our first grandson is born, Isaac. And Kate hasn't been her girlfriend talked with her about ovarian cancer, and she walked closely with her through that. She was a female pastor, just surrounded them, created. Well, her husband, put off right in the church. I get married, you know, you're not Catholic, you can't go to communion, you know. But he said to her, I think I can. And she announces to us that she wants Isaac to be baptized. I had arrogant reactions. How do we find out? You know, he's like, I should have been, you know, it's like the richness of, you know, and it's not that I don't respect Lutherans, you know, but does she want to let go of or throw it? I'm driving Tony Shipley, our board member, the Methodist pastor, to the airport, and I'm telling him the story. And I said, you got guys, she talked to him, and he said, I mean, he just, he said, yeah, I think you could, if you could listen to it, but I don't know if you could just, I mean, what he said to me, you know, it's like, and
the child is being baptized.
Yes!
That's right.
And that's where I
don't forget the purpose here, right?
If the next generation does not operate
God loyalty,
and that's not even the
loyalties, but barriers.
Yes, there are barriers.
Loyalties, but barriers that are self-imposed, and many are not.
And when I listen to them, just again, here's a woman who loves God, loves her husband. She so wants to be a family. For her to go to a Catholic church and her husband to not go, there's an inkling of openness here, and she wants to be a part of a faith community, and they've been deeply touched. This was the way. I mean, she was fearful, you know, was I or her mother going to react? Or, and largely because of Tony, I had the grace to just listen, and all of a sudden, you know, just be inspired by her. Her faith and her commitment to her marriage and to her family and to living a Christian life. In the light of prophetic dialogue, which is this talk is prophetic dialogue. Like,
I think it looks like and sounds like what we're having around this table.
I'd like to just raise a metaphor that I've struggled with in the presentation. I don't think we can hold partnership and leadership together. I think we have a baggage of leadership where it is hierarchical. And the image I had was when he talked about God sent the Spirit into creation. The Spirit had to negotiate every single step of creation. And we know on this planet that in that negotiation, it's different in different places. And then I thought about Abraham, and God sent Abraham, but then God had to negotiate every single step with him. And I think our leadership model is one in which we think we've got the answers, and so we lead. And I think there's something radically different with partnership as an image for what we're supposed to be doing. And it is around this listening, but I'm just really... And so even when he ended up saying the Spirit leads, I'm not sure the Spirit does lead. They can partner, but I think it is a dance, and when you dance with somebody, you actually are not leading. You're in some kind of a... So I...
Good.
We have a leadership issue, I think. This goes way back in the way we've been trying to do it.
Let me interrupt. If your table is at all like mine, it's rich, and it doesn't deserve to be interrupted. Let me just say, you need a break, and we're going to move to start the Bible study about 4 o'clock, at 4 o'clock. So take a break if you need, continue to talk if you need. And,
I'm 30.
Amen.
So come and see us tomorrow.
I will.
Where is tomorrow?
Well, I am here. I am completely, so I'm going to be in tomorrow.
Ah.
Thank you for the rich conversation.
Yes.
I didn't want to get up. But
I don't want to leave you.
But what's going to happen is just even this Bible study will take us deeper and we'll just build. And I mean, it just know it certainly will not be disruptive when you sneak back in, however you do, and if you can. And
I'll just move back in.
And we'll just.
Tomorrow I'll try to get in here in the morning.
Tell me when and if you can. The schedule's all there and you can see. And, but gentle with you.
Yeah. I have a, tomorrow night a wedding and commitments to that today, so I'll
you're doing a dance. Jeff, thank you for that.
Yes, indeed.
That rich.
Well, it just came at the end. Yeah. I haven't processed it yet.
Right.
Oh, you got the rocky.
You're at our table.
You have a chair at this table.
I have a chair. Wow.
Should be on your name.
Oh, it probably is. But
yep, reconciliation. This is the reconciliation. So just so you know, if you want to sneak in and join us at any point, you're welcome.